This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Meg Wolitzer, has written a new novel called The 10-Year Nap, about highly educated working women who have given up their careers to stay home and raise their children. The main character, Amy, left her job as a corporate lawyer to have a baby. She planned to return after a brief maternity leave, but when the novel opens 10 years later, she's still home raising her son. As Wolitzer writes, unlike in the past, there were no presentations to give to colleagues. There were no colleagues. Amy and her three good friends have different degrees of ambivalence about their decisions to leave work for motherhood. The novel follows how leaving the working world has affected their identities and their marriages. Wolitzer is also the author of The Wife, The Position, and Surrender Dorothy. Meg Wolitzer, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from your new novel, The 10-Year Nap. Would you introduce it for us?
Sure. This is sort of toward the beginning of the novel, and one of my characters is named Amy Lamb, and she is a stay-at-home mother now who left being a lawyer years ago, and her son is now 10 years old, hence the 10 years of the title. And this is sort of about her day, and it's just a little bit of the kind of interior life of being a mother, someone who has left the workforce and is spending her day as a stay-at-home mother. There were empty segments of time in the day, and Amy had become highly aware of them. She had only infrequently regretted being at home with Mason when he was little. There had been boring times and maddening times, but there were moments when he wanted only her, and there were also sudden bursts of the extraordinary. There was always so much to do. There were lists and plans and schedules that were essential to a well-run household and that were still laughably, almost hysterically tedious. You, the brainy, restless female, were the one who had to keep your family life rolling forward like a tank. You, of all people, were in charge of snacks. Your hands tore apart the cellophane on six packs of juice boxes, while your head cocked to hold a cordless phone into which you spoke the words, "Maureen? Hi, it's Mason Buckner's mom. I'm calling to set up a play date with Jared." You had to say play date, that non-word that had so easily been welcomed into the lexicon, and you had to say it without irony. Certainly you could also focus the thick, keen lens of your intellect on the greater world if you wanted. You could anguish over the war that ground on far away on another continent, and Amy did dwell on it periodically, hopelessly, during the day. But you would have to do this on your own time, between plans. You were the gatekeeper and nerve center and the pulsing, chugging heart of your family, the one whom everyone came to and needed things from. You were the one who had to coax that unconscious child from his bed day upon day.
That's Meg Wolitzer reading from her new novel, The 10-Year Nap. Meg, did you find the playdate era more difficult than the baby and toddler era?
Yes, definitely. I can't say words like playdate and juice box without feeling that they're somehow a corruption of language, and yet they have been absorbed into the vocabulary of motherhood. But it was hard for me to make that leap and to not feel that everything had little quote marks around it and that I was being ironic.
And why was it harder?
I'm not sure. When I became a mother, I didn't know what I would feel about motherhood. I thought that there would always be a kind of winking irony in everything I did, and there wasn't always. Some things don't require irony. Sometimes I even found myself irritated at the way in which certain kids' TV shows, baby TV shows, needed to put in something for the parents to relate to, some cultural reference from the baby boomer era. Some things are just for the kids, and some things are without irony. And a lot of stuff in early childhood is. I found myself, as a young mother, overwhelmed by that. I wanted the irony. I thought that, maybe motherhood and hanging out in a playgroup could be kind of like Dorothy Parker in the Algonquin Round Table, but with, with baby bumpers on the edges of the round table. It wasn't always like that. But after a while, there's great profundity and great beauty in spending time with young children. I think it's been mocked a lot in the culture.
Why did you want to write a novel about women who've given up, at least for now, their careers to have children?
Because it was something that I saw that I hadn't seen before. I grew up thinking that everyone would find their passion, everyone would find the job that they loved. I did. But it hadn't really occurred to me that for a lot of people, work is work, and it isn't the great, deep, and abiding pleasure and passion that it turned out to be for me. I knew women who'd gone to law school sort of for lack of other ideas because they were verbal and really smart and didn't know quite what to do with their lives. And some of them who ended up in corporate jobs didn't like them so much. And then when it came time to go back after they'd had their kids, they were resistant to it. They weren't sure what they were going back to. They were going back sometimes to a corporate world that didn't love them or need them or want them in the way that, in some senses, their children did. And I started seeing these women and liking them. I met them through my kids' school when they were young. They were all smart and educated. They were feminists. They were interested in the world, but they didn't quite know what to do. And I thought, I hadn't seen this done in fiction. There were various books about, you know, what happens if women work, what happens if women don't work, that use statistics, that made a point, that could be polemics. And I thought, what if I just kind of showed what it was like? What if I set for myself the idea of having every main character not have a job?
Now, your main character, Amy, when she leaves her law firm after she starts her maternity leave, she says, you know, don't move anything on my desk. I'm going to be back after 12 weeks. And then 12 weeks are up and she realizes she can't. She can't leave her baby, at least not yet. Why does she feel she can't go back to work?
You know, I have a little passage about this. Could I possibly read from it? It may take me a second to find it. Okay. But 12 weeks proved to be nothing, and when the time was up, it was as though an alarm had suddenly gone off, sending electronic doves cooing, chickens squawking, and horses galloping, the entire rotation of animals in a clamor as if there were a fire in a barn, and yet she could just not get up. She could not leave the apartment, that crazy land of strewn burp rags and unironed miniature outfits and gifts of rattles and soft pillow books that still lay with the detritus of their wrapping paper all around them. The garbage overflowed, the baby confused day with night, and anyone in her right mind would have wanted to run from that place and return to the sharp corners and fragrant tang of the office climate with its industrial carpet and stuttering fluorescent lights that forced you awake in the morning like a flask of ammonia passed under the nose. But a new mother was not in her right mind. Something overcame her, and her entire purpose was to save that baby, as though she was a superhero flying with arms outstretched through the metropolitan sky. Even a quick trip to the Korean market for yogurt and juice was interminable, and Amy ran the 3 short blocks back to the building. She could not leave Mason yet. She loved him too much for that. But neither could she turn him over to some woman from Jamaica or Guyana or Mount Olympus. She could not turn him over to the kindest, softest woman in the world. Even a gigantic, gelatinous, floating human breast would not be good enough.
Did you write that paragraph out of your own feelings? Feelings that surprised you about your inability to leave your baby for more than a few minutes?
Yes, I did. How could you tell? I really did. I think something chemical happened, and there was a sense that, you know, I was needed. And even when milk had been expressed and everything was taken care of, and someone says, now you go off and relax. You go see some trashy Brad Pitt movie. We'll be fine here for a couple of hours. And I did this. I remember sweating, sitting away from my infant and feeling a certain kind of dread that something would go wrong because I wasn't there. And there is a funny narcissism to that idea that you have to be the one there, that your husband is this kind of Fred Flintstone character who couldn't really do anything right and, you know, is duh. And you come in as this absolute superwoman and, you know, sort of take over everything. And of course, it's not true. But I think some of it is really chemical.
You know, you also write about how it changes Amy's marriage once the baby's born and she's staying home to take care of the baby. You know, she and her husband met at the law firm. They both work there. There were the couple having the office flirtation, then the couple in love, and then the young newlyweds at the office. And he's still there and she's not. And so this happens with a lot of couples, that the thing that brought them together, their work, is no longer something they share once a child is born and the woman leaves work, at least temporarily.
Yeah, I felt that this was something that I'd seen and heard about quite a bit. I have a reference in the novel to another character who supposedly finds out that her husband takes Ritalin every day so that he can bear to listen when his wife talks to him about her day. That the idea that people's lives are boring to each other if they don't overlap. I don't know that that's true. You know, it's sort of like that thing that happens, at any rate, it happens in New York quite a bit, where you go to a party and someone says, "What do you do?" And that's by way of introduction. And if the answer isn't something interesting to them, you can see the eye roll and the head sort of swivel away. If you say, "I stay at home," and I could see something like that happening within a marriage in which work that was once a passion for both people in a marriage now is not something they share, and it creates sometimes a fissure between them.
My guest is Meg Wolitzer. She's the author of several novels, including The Position, The Wife, Surrender Dorothy. Her new novel is called The 10-Year Nap, and it's about four women who leave their careers to stay home and raise their children. Now, the main character, Amy, her mother became a feminist and started writing women's novels that addressed women's issues. And this was after the children were born that she became a writer. And the mother expected the children's, you know, her daughters' lives would be different from hers. She considers her daughters the post-speculum generation. What does she mean by that?
Yeah, I was going to say, out of context, the speculum reference is about a consciousness-raising group in Canada when Amy was growing up. And her mother had a group of local friends over, and they invited an educator from Toronto to come in with her black bag, which contained a speculum, and she did a self-exam so that the women could see their internal parts. And for Amy's mother, this was the beginning of a sort of awakening toward the possibilities of her life, metaphorically very much, because there's also just the uncomfortable factor of it as well. The kind of, I mean, I'm somewhat jabbing a little bit at that era and at the sort of our bodies, ourselves era. I did, in fact, have a class in college that was women only, and someone came in and did a self-exam. And, you know, this was the 70s, as you might guess. And I remember my face heating up, but I also remember thinking, wow, there's something about being a woman at this point in time, and what will I do with my life? And it was all connected to things. I think that one thing that can happen when you stay home with your children is that you get to know other women, and there's this kind of collegiality that can take place that you had maybe in college, a sort of joking around quality with other women. The day is yours. You're not disappearing into an office. But Amy's mother really wants her daughter, imagines her daughter will be a world beater, will sort of rule the world. And that didn't happen for everybody. The notion of having it all is some kind of magazine article idea. But somebody said once that to me that, you know, well, you could have a lot of most of it. And I think that's a pretty good way to see it.
Meg, you have two sons. Mm-hmm. And Amy, your main character, has a son who's 10 years old. And she's given the advice by a well-meaning person. And the advice is, the thing you have to understand about boys is that sometimes they're simple. All they need is to be run like dogs. And at first she thinks, like, what a horrible thing to say about boys. But then something happens to her that makes her think, well, there's some truth in this. Describe the story that happens to her.
She sends her son to a boys' school. And I wanted to have a little fun with that idea of sort of boys together, which I fear in the book, if, you know, boys in large groups could almost become Lord of the Flies. Her son is not exactly like her. And I think that there is something in that, the sort of insult of the idea that your child is not just a little version of you. And mothers of sons do have to face that. I was saying to somebody yesterday that I feel like my children practically came out saying vroom, vroom. And that certainly did not come from me. I had a fantasy that, of course, I would have a daughter because I grew up with a very strong mother and with a sister. So in that sense, it felt like a matriarchy, that with my children, they would you know, read The Secret Garden with me in my lap. Now, they did, but, you know, I had to hold them down with a safety belt and dress them in frocks. No, I mean, I think that if you're a woman who has a son, it's easier to see that this is a different person from you. And Amy has to sort of learn about this. I was curious in the book about what the boys think of these women who devote themselves to the children. Will the boys think this is what women will always do? But I didn't really reach a conclusion. I mean, I think that that would be too simplistic to say that that's the way the boys see it. But the older group, the mothers, you know, it's about these women. There's all mothers. And then the younger ones are pretty much all boys. There's a girl. There's a significant girl character in the book. But they are boys. And I think that in certain ways, the mothers are envious of the boys' freedom from constraint, the wildness that the mothers sort of allow them. I felt that I heard somebody say that about boys need to be run like animals, run like dogs. But weirdly, there was some pride in that. There's sort of strange pride that mothers sometimes take in the gender of their kids.
You know, you say that you were given that advice that sometimes a boy has to be run like a dog. There's a story that comes with that in the novel, and I was wondering if this happened to you too, where, you know, Amy, the mother, is at the Y with her son where he's been swimming. And so as she's changing back into her clothes, he like runs out the door into the street and she's like, oh my God, like he's running into the world and God knows what's going to happen to him. She's naked. So she takes a towel, wraps it around her and charges out after him.
That
happened to you?
It completely happened to me. This was like, I don't like to write autobiographically. I really don't. None of my friends ever has to worry that they'll appear in a book. There's nothing like that. It would be too boring to do that, except I can pick and choose from little things that have happened to me. This did happen. I took my son Gabriel to a swimming class, and he at this point was the one who kind of ran off everywhere, and we were getting changed after it. And in fact, he did run out into the lobby, and the towels that they had at the time were like the size of a Kleenex. And I had to make a decision, what do I cover, you know, my breasts or below? And I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I decided, and I covered my top and ran out into this lobby full of like old men and walkers and people waiting for their folk dance class. It was just the worst situation, a brightly lit lobby, as my son almost went into the elevator in this urban building to never be seen again. And I grabbed him, but it was a horrible moment for me, the naked woman in the lobby. But afterward, I had a conversation with my friends and we went around the room asking, and I put this in the book, what would you have covered? And, you know, one would say the top, one would say the bottom. And the only good answer a friend said was, I would have covered my face. And I put that in the book. And, of course, that's the right answer.
So what did you say to your son when – how old was your son? How comprehensive?
Too young to be traumatized, but he was probably three. You know, I think those are moments there – they're horrible. They're not, to get back to the idea of irony and motherhood, they're not ironic at the moment. They're just horrible. And yet later they are, because those are the moments that you remember that make up the sort of chain of events that was your son's childhood that you'll never forget, that you can laugh about later, that seemed horrible at the time, but that in fact say something about you and your nervousness and your pleasure and your time with him and the closeness that you had. I mean, I loved spending time with him. My children are too old to be read to now, which makes me quite sad. But when I think about happiness, I often think about the moments of quiet and sitting together, reading.
You have a paragraph in your new novel about Amy's son. And, you know, she talks about how when her son was a baby, his body belonged to her. And when she would diaper him, you know, every bit of his body was just kind of hers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but when he got older, there was a part of his body that she couldn't, it was you know, his private parts were completely off limits to her. She didn't even know what they looked like anymore.
Right.
And it would be inappropriate for her to know. And it's just the sense of loss that she has. I mean, she knows why he can't physically be hers anymore, but it makes him kind of out of reach in a way that she feels unprepared for. It's a loss.
It's a real loss. I feel that very much in my life. The loss of closeness. I mean, the whole thing about having a baby is that it's kind of like a living Mary Cassatt painting. You are with this baby. You know, you don't know where one flesh begins and one ends. They need you. You need them. It's symbiotic. It's all, you know, fleshy and earthy and so wonderful, if you like that kind of thing, which I do. And as they get older, there are little bits of independence. Some of them are symbolic. The first time they do this, the first time they do that. But for a while, I think you think of it only in a good way. You're proud, but you're still proud in a kind of ownership way. But the way in which everything the child does is a reflection of you, that starts to happen less and less. And their physical bodies become less yours. And particularly with a boy, you know, I remember the first time my younger son, Charlie, sort of said, you know, go away or close the door. Wow. And I felt uncomfortable with it, but it was right, of course. But there's a real loss because it's not, it's the loss of the thing you thought was yours. And of course it isn't yours. And every mother knows this eventually.
You know, one of the things, one of the issues that comes up in your novel is the affair. And without getting into the plot here, I'm just curious about some of the things that you thought about when you were writing about an affair in the novel. Did you have certain insights into its pleasures and hazards?
I thought that writing about an affair would be an interesting thing to do in the context of a group of women who aren't working and don't have a sort of engine to their day except the engine that they want to create. What happens when a woman in their midst, not one of their close friends, has an affair that one of them learns about? I felt that this character, Penny, who has the affair, was not so much as of a full character as these other women, as a kind of figure that these women had a transference toward. She was the one who seemed to have everything. She was the one who seemed to have the kind of job that I described earlier. You know, you make a character have in a book and then you're supposed to be impressed by. She runs a small museum. She's very beautiful. She's very smart. She's well-educated. And as it turns out, she's having an affair with a young, kind of good-looking English guy. This would be something that I think these women would all sort of perk up at. I once had lunch with a group of friends, and this was years ago, and I sort of said, I'm taking a survey. What do you want to read about in a novel? You know, this is a very unscientific survey. And right away, at the same time, like one and then another said, someone having an affair. That maybe that there, I think that the affair is just sort of a stand-in for the idea of something new and exciting. In the middle of your life, there is a sadness and a recognition that, you know, you've created a lot of what will be. Your children now are sort of who they are. They will change. They will, their lives will go through transformations, but you've done your main work. Your marriage is kind of what it is. But an affair is something new. It's almost like having a baby. It's this new, exciting thing that could go in any direction, and it's about possibilities. But better yet is that it's not your affair. It's someone else's. So then you can kind of follow it like a soap opera. That's why I really wanted to put it in the book.
The main character, Amy, her mother, who became a feminist in the 70s, thought that her daughters would do important things with their lives. And Amy has given up her law career, which she never felt particularly passionate about, to be home raising her son. Mm-hmm. Do you, the author, think that it's any less important to be home raising your child than it is to be out in the world having a, quote, important career?
No, I think that as I have one of my characters say, because it's something that I realize, that, you know, work doesn't make you interesting. You know, interesting work can make you interesting. And really, I come down on the side of purpose. I think that a sense of purpose is what matters most. to one's life to sort of get you through it. You know, when I started writing this, I thought, I don't know where I stand on working versus not working. I mean, who am I to really say you should work? There are various legal concerns and monetary concerns, but putting that aside, because that's for the nonfiction books, really, who am I to say that one kind of life is better than another? And, you know, because if you feel that it is, then that would mean that sitting next to the guy who works in equities or marketing at Revlon is always going to be a more interesting evening than sitting next to the woman who's home with her children. And it's really about people. It's not necessarily about what they do. If you don't love your work, you won't speak about it with passion. I wanted to set up the dichotomy not really being between staying at home with your children versus work, but because that's been done a lot before. But I wanted to sort of set it up between what happens when the children are older and don't need you as much. So you're not really home with them. You may be home, but not with them. They're in school full time by the time, you know, when this book takes place. The kids are in school full time. And now is the moment when these women are going to think about their lives and decide what to do. And I am not, as the writer of the book, if I'm judgmental, if I have an agenda, if it's a polemic, then it doesn't feel like a good novel to me. That's not the role of the novelist.
Well, Meg Wolitzer, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, too.
Meg Wolitzer's new novel is called The 10-Year Nap. Just a few days after last week's fifth anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the coalition military death toll reached 4,000. The war has divided America. The invasion and the occupation also divided the Bush administration, and that's the subject of Bush's War, the new two-part PBS Frontline documentary that airs tonight and tomorrow night. My guest is the producer, Michael Kirk. He's produced several Frontline documentaries about the Bush administration and the war in Iraq, including The Lost Year in Iraq, Rumsfeld's War, The Dark Side, and Gunning for Saddam. The new documentary, Bush's War, includes material from previous Frontline editions as well as new interviews. The documentary is titled Bush's War, but in a way, Bush isn't even one of the main characters in the documentary. The main characters are more like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Powell and Condoleezza Rice, Tenet. Do you really see it as Bush's war? Do you see it as other people's war and Bush goes along for the ride?
Certainly, you know, as we were making all of these films, we kept saying to ourselves, and people would often say to us when they saw one of the films, where's the president? And in a way, he wasn't really engaged. Everybody we've talked to about this says until the spring, really, of 2006, the president was a much more passive player in the war in Iraq than many people would believe or expect. But he is, after all, the president. And so he does, you know, in lots of ways, he dictated fine-grained parts of the decisions, and he was also the object of everyone's attention. They, you know, were battling for access to him, not so much because of whatever he would decide, but because it gave them a leg up on their opponent. If you're Rumsfeld, you want to have implied to Powell that you've been seeing a lot more of the president than he has, for example.
Now, your documentary shows that right from the start, there was conflict between Tenet and his CIA and Rumsfeld and his Defense Department over who was running the show. What was the first conflict between them after September 11th?
Well, it became fairly clear that the Defense Department was not in any way prepared. There were no plans, for example, to go to war in Afghanistan. It is a place that all militaries around the world, especially the United States military, remember as the place that took the Soviet Union down. Nobody wanted to think very seriously about ever going anywhere near Afghanistan. But the CIA had a plan. They had an ongoing kind of idea about a way to take places like Afghanistan, if ever there were the war on terror that they kept believing was going to eventuate. So from the very beginning, the first argument is between the big, heavy military and Rumsfeld within the Defense Department and Rumsfeld and George Tenet. In other words, the Central Intelligence Agency wanted small, light, nimble attack forces, that they would go in and do things covertly. The heavy United States military, the Army especially, said, no, it's going to take 7 months and hundreds of thousands of people, and we want to do it with strategic bombing, et cetera, the usual game plan. And Rumsfeld himself, who was as head of secretary or as Secretary of Defense and in an ongoing battle with the military to transform the way they fought, wanted something in between what the CIA had and the military wanted. So there were really three forces at bay in those early days about what to do about Afghanistan, and the CIA eventually won.
So the CIA goes in first, and the way you describe it in the documentary Bush's War, the CIA does its covert work in Afghanistan, and then it's ready for the military to come in. But the military doesn't come in yet. The CIA waits for nearly a month for the military to come in. Why?
Well, you know, the way that everybody tells us the story, Rumsfeld was very upset about the fact that he was going to have to follow the lead of the Central Intelligence Agency of all places, that he would have to be second to George Tenet of all people, and that essentially what Rumsfeld did was hold everything kind of in the background while the CIA waited for him to come forward with the troops, the special forces that would be necessary to execute the phase of the CIA's plan that would swing the Northern Alliance into action against the Taliban. They waited for 30 days up in the valleys, some of the CIA agents waiting for Rumsfeld to come in, to order his guys to come in. And it isn't until a National Security Council meeting that Richard Armitage in our film talks about in the first person, where he says to the president, "I think things are foobar." The president is wondering, why isn't anything happening in Afghanistan? If you'll recall, the press was reporting quagmire. In the end, of course, the president chooses Don Rumsfeld to be in charge. And as soon as he gives Rumsfeld the lead, the forces begin to arrive, and Kabul falls 3 days later.
So what did we lose? Did we lose something during that period when the military wasn't going in? And the way you describe it, it's as if Rumsfeld was holding them up until he got control, until he was given the power.
It may not be so much that we lost anything. It's the potential for what could have happened. And, of course, who knows how different the war on terror would be if the CIA had been given their head to lead what is an asymmetrical war, after all. I know they believe, when you talk to Central Intelligence Agency officers at the highest level, they all believe in that they were ready to fight kind of across the board, across the map, 80 different countries, all kinds of efforts that they were ready to go with, and especially once they'd been given the legal authority to go to the dark side. They really believed that they could eradicate, or at least go after and seriously diminish al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations that they were watching for. The nature of the conflict, of course, would change dramatically.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Kirk, and he's produced many frontline documentaries on the war in Iraq, and his latest is a two-part program called Bush's War that airs tonight and tomorrow night on most public television stations. Now, this documentary goes over a lot of the conflicts in the Bush administration, and it goes into how Colin Powell, who was then Secretary of State, was shut out of some of the major decision-making. For instance, he was shut out on the decisions to set up military tribunals, to dispense with the Geneva Conventions, to do extreme interrogation techniques. Why was he shut out, and who shut him out?
I think it's pretty clear in the film. We kind of went back in history a little bit to figure out what was at the heart of the disagreement between Rumsfeld primarily and Colin Powell. As you know, the State Department and the Defense Department across many administrations have always been slightly at odds. But this is unusual, and this is also personal in the sense that the two individuals, Rumsfeld and Powell, don't really seem to like each other. And the vice president, who's had a longstanding, obviously, relationship, 40-year political friendship and alliance with Don Rumsfeld, also doesn't seem to like Powell very much. We date the actual moment when it happens as the very first day of the Bush administration back in December after the Florida decision had been handed down by the Supreme Court, and the President of the United States names Colin Powell in a kind of healing gesture as Secretary of State. Powell gives a very expansive press conference. In that press conference, he kind of veers, as former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, kind of veers between military and diplomatic, and it seems like what he's it appears to certainly the vice president and other conservative supporters of the president that really what this moderate Colin Powell is doing is acting like both Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, and of course they can't brook that. And Don Rumsfeld is brought on to be the sort of anti-Powell force inside the administration, and he becomes that. And they go at it for 9 months before the months right before 9/11. And of course, after 9/11, their worldviews become very apparent, and all the things that follow for Colin Powell and Don Rumsfeld.
Now, Condoleezza Rice was shut out of a lot of decision-making, too, when she was the National Security Advisor. And Elizabeth Buemiller, in your documentary, who's a New York Times reporter who wrote a recent book about Condoleezza Rice, tells an incredible story about the extremes that Rice sometimes had to go through to get information. Would you tell the story she tells?
Yes, it's completely astonishing when you think about it, that the National Security Advisor of the United States and a person who had a personal friendship with the President of the United States actually had so little power in the run-up to the war, partly because she was surrounded by what one person in our film calls the elephants in the room, very big, powerful men like Colin Powell and Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Rumsfeld treated her, Elizabeth says in the film, like a graduate student, a Russian studies graduate student. He was very secretive anyway, always holding very close all of the information about troop plans and ideas for how they were going to do what they were going to do in Iraq. But she felt by necessity that she needed to know some things. But Rumsfeld rarely spoke directly to her in most meetings, and she couldn't gather the information. So what Elizabeth Buemiller tells us is that what Condoleezza Rice, the National Security Advisor of the United States of America and a close personal friend of the president, had to do to get troop information from the Secretary of Defense was one of the members of the National Security Council staff would put on a uniform, a military uniform, and go over to the Pentagon and access information based on their role as a military member, not as a member of Rice's staff. That's that I think to almost anybody who hears it and knows how the inner circle works finds it just astonishing that such a thing would eventuate.
My guest is Michael Kirk, and he's produced many frontline documentaries on the war in Iraq, and his latest, Bush's War, is a two-part program that airs tonight and tomorrow night on most PBS stations. The documentary looks at a lot of conflicts within the Bush administration in the lead-up to the war and after regime change in Iraq. It also looks at some of the conflicts between President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair, and you have a new interview in there with the man who was then the ambassador from England to the United States. And he tells you an interesting story about the deal between President Bush and Tony Blair. Would you tell what that deal was?
Yes, right after 9/11, literally the day after 9/11, in England, you know, Tony Blair doesn't know George Bush very well, certainly is uneasy about what might happen. They're afraid, as Ambassador Meyer tells us, they're afraid of some cowboy action by the unknown and freshly minted American president that maybe has a hair trigger, that maybe something untoward will happen in the Middle East or somewhere else, maybe even in a European capital. They don't really know what he's going to do. And so Blair's task from the onset is to get to the new president and find out and be assured by the new president that America will move carefully in the direction of al-Qaeda and no place else. He comes to the president, talks to the president, and is assured that everything will be all right. He comes to Washington worried because there have been noises from almost the very beginning that America is aiming for Iraq ultimately. He's worried about that, Blair. He comes to Bush and says, I'm really worried about this. The president assures him that Afghanistan and the Taliban and al-Qaeda are job one for the United States, and anything that follows in the future is still not been decided. It makes Blair feel pretty sure that everything's going to be okay. But Blair is very, very interested throughout this time in making sure that the United States goes to the United Nations and cuts the rest of the world in, especially Europe, into the decision that the president, Blair, is an ally of Secretary of State Powell's. And they're very interested in making sure that a broad-based coalition supports any effort that happens in the war on terror. And the president assures him that in the end that he will go to the United Nations and seek a resolution. But in return, he wants Blair to promise him that if the United States exhausts the process at the United Nations, he, Blair, will support them if they decide to go to war, no matter what. And Blair, realizing the implications of this, I think, still agrees to do it. And in the end, according to Chris Meyer, his ambassador and others in his government, gives away Britain's leverage at exactly that moment, much to their chagrin.
You've done so many investigations into the war in Iraq, what happened behind the scenes. What do you still want to know?
Oh, that's a great question. I want to know why and how a group of people working together, maybe even with really good intentions, found themselves not wanting to brook any outside opinion. How is it that you can function at such a high and important level and want to exclude all the forces that are designed and built into the system to act as a brake on policymakers who want to go forward based on information and intelligence but shouldn't? How did that happen? And the second level is how personality, just how those personalities could so impact policy. What is it about the dynamic between, as I call them, these big Shakespearean characters has taken place that caused them to go the way they went here and there? And finally, why didn't Colin Powell resign? Why didn't George
Tenet protest, resign? In protest, you mean, resign in
yes.
protest instead of being pushed
yes.
out?
Exactly. At the moment that if they really felt as strongly as their surrogates tell us they felt, why didn't they go when they could have had an impact on closing something down? That is always fascinating to me about policymakers.
Do you ever wonder if President Bush ever has second thoughts about the war?
It is a question I ask everybody who knows him fairly well and the people who've been in meetings with him, and they always say that he's a man who makes up his mind fairly quickly, and when he does, he thinks it's wrong to change it, so that it somehow shows a kind of weakness. And that is fascinating to me because it means that I think there's a kind of certainty there that seems to be part of the hard wiring of the president that has manifested itself in what has happened in Iraq and the Middle East.
Michael Kirk, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Terry.
Michael Kirk produced the two-part Frontline documentary, Bush's War. It airs tonight and tomorrow night. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.